I want to talk about cosmology, loop quantum gravity in a slightly different flavor. Before starting, as you see in the slide, I want to mention that today we celebrated the International Day of Women in Mathematics. And even if I feel very strong my identity as a theoretical physicist, I am a physicist, I'm not a mathematician. But, well, okay, so I think we do enough mathematics to be included in the celebration. So I hope you enjoy the day, all the women that are in the audience and feel the empowerment of it, of this celebration.
Because we don't for the other 364
days. maybe something today we just feel more mathematician than usual. Let's put it in this way. Okay. So I wanted to tell you about some work that has been going on in order to extract the primordial fluctuations from quantum gravity. And let me start with the usual scenario that is my motivation for talking about this. So the standard cosmological scenario is the one in which we have a Big Bang, a singularity, and then inflation take place. And there is an agreement that the initial fluctuations of the geometry that are in fact quantum fluctuations are evolved through inflation. They are stretched in inflation and they provide the seeds of structure formation. In order to do this, you have to match the observation at late time, and by late time I mean after inflation. What we observe is the CMB. We have to match these observations with an initial quantum state that is taken usually to be the Bunch-Davis vacuum. Why the Bunch-Davis vacuum? Simply because it is the one that fits well with our model, with our cosmological model, with the inflationary scenario. But so you have to choose it, and your choice will give different results. In loop quantum cosmology, there is a very large literature of this application of loop quantum gravity to cosmology. There are more than 20 years of work that I'm not going to review in this talk, so I just wanted to refer to the last, the most recent review on the subject, that is this one, that makes a nice job in describing the connection between the theory and the observations. But so the main result in loop quantum cosmology is the absence of curvature singularities. This has been explored in many different settings. For different cosmological models with anisotropy, inhomogeneities, and so on. And the singularity resolution is robust. Instead of a Big Bang, there is a big bounce. So the universe may have been in a contracting phase before the expanding one that we see today. So we can think of this as a quantum tunneling from a contracting solution of the Einstein equation to an expanding one through a quantum region where we have a maximal curvature and a maximal energy density at the Planck, in the Planck regime. Most of the work in loop quantum cosmology has been done using inflation, using an inflaton field. And what is nice here is the fact that in this context, inflation is completely generic, so there is no necessity of fine-tuning the initial condition. And what happens is that the contracting phase of the universe naturally makes the potential, the energy of the the inflaton field the inflaton field to climb up the potential. So inflation fits well with this scenario. And there are, as I said, plenty of results and possible observational signature. Still, there is the question of what is the initial vacuum state that also in this case needs to be chosen. But so the idea of this talk is to explore more what in loop quantum gravity can be said about the initial state of the universe. So trying to extract directly from the full theory what this initial vacuum state could be. And before going into this, I wanted to point to you a fact that legitimate what we are doing when we do quantum cosmology. So Carlo in the previous talk was stressing the fact that when we do computations for black holes with a black to white transition, we can take part of space-time as being classical and another part as being the quantum region that we want to prove. So we make a partition into the classical part and the quantum part. Now you can ask yourself, where is this partition in cosmology? And the answer to this is that when we do cosmology, we do an expansion in degrees of freedom in which we describe the largest scale of the universe that corresponds to the scale factor. And then we can continue, we can sum up other terms corresponding to finer and finer modes, recovering the full theory, the full general relativity. But so in cosmology, we focus only on the first terms of this expansion. And the first term, the scale factor, was in a quantum state in the very early universe. So we wanted to describe the quantum properties of the scale factor and of the first terms of this expansion corresponding to some few inhomogeneities and anisotropies. And where are we in this? We are not, the degrees of freedom of us don't correspond, they are outside the degrees of freedom of cosmology. They are out in two senses. First, because we are very, very small. We are a mode with a very large number with respect to the one that corresponds to the scale factor. But also, we are at late time, and what we are probing is this physics of the early universe. So this put us out of quantum cosmology, being a classical observer that probe a different mode that is a quantum mode, since we are exploring how it was in the early universe, when this mode that is now large was very small and very quantum. So I wanted to use loop quantum gravity. You know, loop quantum gravity, Robert before was asking the question, where are the loops? So I would say that any theory that is based on loop variables, so by loop variables, I mean group, so I start with general relativity. I analyze the Hamiltonian structure of general relativity. I recognize the presence of fundamental symmetries, in particular the Lorentz symmetry. So if you want, you can do quantum gravity by recognizing that general relativity is a gauge theory, where the gauge group is the Lorentz group. And then I can write my conjugate variables, the group variables, and this group variables requires a loop quantization. So this is what happens at the kinematical level of the theory. So every theory that shares this kind of kinematics, to me, it's a loop quantum gravity theory. But then you can do different choices for the dynamics. In particular, there are two possible choices. One is to work in the canonical framework, and one is to work in a covariant framework. The canonical framework is the one in which you use these conjugate variables with a Hamiltonian, that is in fact an Hamiltonian constraint, that you quantize. And so you put a hat on your Hamiltonian if you want. Or you can do something else that is, the correspondent of a path integral formulation of the theory, where there are Feynman graphs the analog of Feynman graphs for gravity. And from each of the term or each of these graphs, I can write a piece in my expression that gives a transition amplitude. So a probability to go from one state of the quantum geometry to another state of the quantum geometry. So loop quantum cosmology is being developed using the canonical framework. And what I want to do is to see how I can exploit the covariant theory to extract informations that are relevant for cosmology. So here I have a gravity, I quantize it, and I want to look at the quantization using this covariant framework that I write here. This is the general expression for my transition amplitude that Carlo have presented before. So, you know, when we do cosmology, the usual path we take is first to start with general relativity, take a symmetry reduction, that's the way in which you reduce yourself to one or few degrees of freedom. And then, historically, what happened was that working with just one or few degrees of freedom was much more convenient, was simpler to go to the quantum theory. So if you think of what, for instance, Hawking did, Halliwell did, and Hartle did, was to just look at the symmetry reduced quantization, writing a quantum cosmology in this case. And so you can do also writing a Villard-De-Witt equation just for the having as variable your scale factor, and you can write a quantum cosmology in this way. This is the path that has been followed also in loop quantum cosmology, in which you take your loop variables, your group variables, but you reduce them, and you associate them just to the volume and the Hubble rate, a quantum version of the volume and the Hubble rate. And with those variables, you write your quantum cosmological model. What I'm trying to do is to follow a different path. So just start with the full quantum gravity theory and trying to extract their informations about cosmology, try to define quantum cosmological models from the full theory. So of course, in doing this, I'm not taking a full symmetry reduction. So I think of what I have to do is to find some approximation strategies in order to see how a cosmological sector can be taken within the full theory. Now, I wanted to show you an example of how I can extract meaningful information from the full theory without going through all the details of going into defining precisely what the cosmological sector is and so on. So Carlo presented before this few simple steps with which you can arrive to the quantum theory. So the strategy is to start with general relativity. Of course, you need to write it in the good variables. In particular, you have to write the GR using the tetrads and the spin connection. And you wanted to write it with this Hall's term. So once you've read general relativity in a proper way, you discover that general relativity is just a BF theory plus constraints. So the constraints corresponds to imposing peculiar relation between different components of your B field. And this could be a bit opaque, said in this way. So more concretely, if you think of transition amplitudes as giving, as we said, the probability to go from one state to another state, so these states live on the boundary of a four-dimensional geometry, and on the boundary, I can pick up a convenient gauge that corresponds to have a normal defined in this way on the boundary. So once I do this, I am in a convenient situation to interpret what is going on. That is the fact that once I go to the quantum theory, the generator of rotations is proportional to the generators of the boost. So in the Lorentz group, I can see a proportionality between different terms. So this is notice that this is a fact that I can read out at the level of the classical theory, and then I can put hats on K and L, and so this could be a very naive way to tell how to give a recipe of how the quantum theory comes in.
So am I being too naive? You're saying that boost and rotation are the same thing?
Boost and rotations are proportional to one another, yeah.
Right.
And let me give you what comes next. Because from this, I can extract physics. What does it mean that booster rotations are proportional? It means that so the rotations in loop quantum gravity are associated with an area. If you look in the previous slide, so in this slide here, the area is just given by a term, the integration of a term that is E over G, and this gives an area. So equivalent. So if one of my E is E naught, that corresponds to a tetrad taken with the time component. So what I have is that I can define a Lorentzian area, that is here. So you can see the arrow. So I have that. But this is, I think, it's also visible online. So I have an area, a proper area, that is equal or proportional to a Lorentzian area. And what are these areas? So what is a Lorentzian area? Lorentzian areas, we say, they are associated with boost. So so what is this boost? You can think of this boost as the one of an accelerated observer that move here in this Rindler spacetime, and here the integration is taken from a given point in this trajectory to another point of this trajectory. So the accelerated observer is spanning this shaded region, and this is the Lorentzian area that we are talking about. Now, if the area in quantum gravity is discrete, this gives me also, if you want, a discreteness in my Lorentzian area. But this can be translated in terms of a maximal acceleration for this accelerated observer here. And if you have a theory that gives you a maximal acceleration, this is something that has been studied in classical general relativity. Maximal acceleration implies the impossibility to develop curvature singularities. Actually, now I have to open a little parenthesis because there is one single counterexample given by Gerock, but it's for a space-time in which you have to glue together in a very exotic way patches of space-time. So I think that in all relevant physical situation, we can say that maximal acceleration is equal to absence of curvature singularity. And I am very careful to say curvature singularities because, of course, we can have all kinds of other possible singularities, especially in cosmology. We know that there are different quantities that can diverge, pressure can diverge. So what quantum gravity does is only to cure singularities of space-time, not other kind of singularities. Yes?
Are you assuming something about the space-time to make the acceleration a meaningful quantity? I mean, in any space-time, I can always have arbitrarily large accelerated world line at any point. So, but are you thinking of a static space-time, let's say, and only looking at trajectories that follow the Killing orbits? Or what do you mean by acceleration here?
Carlo is not like this, but but I would say that whatever the space-time is, pick up your favorite definition of acceleration for a given observer in a space-time of your choice. I think that the simplicity constraint, the application of the simplicity constraint is always giving you a bound in the acceleration. So you're saying that, so your concern is that suppose that instead, so of course here I am discussing a very simple case in which there is a constant acceleration and a static space-time. Mm-hmm. Your concern is what if I have an evolved space-time and, but I don't see how this could fail. Okay, yeah, Carlo, you're keep on.
The answer should be to those references. Think about relative acceleration of free falling observers near in a high curvature region.
So the tidal tensor from the Riemann tensor.
Sorry?
You're referring to the tidal tensor in any curvature.
So the equation that says.
That's
that
just the components of the Riemann tensor. But then it seems like a tautology. If you say, the curvature is finite, then the curvature is finite.
No, it's from the curvature, what's the name, the geodesic deviation.
Right, that's determined by the tidal tensor, which is just a projection of some components of Riemann. Right. If you assume it's true in all reference frames, then I guess you probably, the finiteness of that for all unit time-like vectors that define the direction of your reference frame probably implies the Riemann tensor is finite.
Yeah.
Yes, but the assumption is, I think the assumption is that it's what comes from the discreteness of the gray area. Yeah.
I mean, if you don't want to pass it through the acceleration, you want to say directly curvature is finite, I'm fine.
Maybe we can sit down and do the.
Okay. I don't.
But can I get some clarification? So, can your objection also applies to a minimum area?
Because if we assume a space time, there is no minimum area. You can always let area go to zero.
Right. So right. But I thought that Francesca was talking about specifically Minkowski space and an area defined by her procedure.
Well,
with a background Minkowski space.
Yeah. Okay. So, but the point is that I can define a generic area. And then in the moment in which I quantize this generic area, this given minimal area, that goes into a minimal Lorentzian area as well. And the minimal Lorentzian. So, I mean, I don't know, if you can read directly from the simplicity constraint, the curvature out of it, that is also the way in which I think myself these days, but seems to me more transparent this way, I mean, to passing through through the acceleration. But I would agree with you that, you can, even without thinking in terms of the Lorentzian area, you can, from the simplicity constraint, you can read directly. So from this from the quantization of this generator of this K, that is the generator of the boost, I can read directly the curvature. And so there is in, oh, actually, there is an inversion. The curvature and the boost are in, are one inversely proportional to one another. So again, minimal boost corresponds to maximal curvature. Maybe we can, maybe you can help me to make it this even more polished and clearer in the way in which I am presenting this, because I really think that this is very powerful, and I want the best possible way to say this very clearly. But for the sake of my talk, what I wanted to say is that here I am just taking the basic equation of the dynamics of the theory, and I'm reading out something that is relevant for cosmology. So I don't have to go through symmetry reduction, as my colleague in loop quantum cosmology have been doing all the time, and study this in the case of Bianchi 1, in the case of Bianchi 2, in the case of Gaudi models, and so on and so forth. So doesn't matter whether there are anisotropies, doesn't matter whether there are inhomogeneities. Since loop quantum gravity is based on the quantization of this equation and is based on this proportionality, I can infer that every theory that is based on my loop variables and on this loop dynamics should give a singularity resolution. So what I can do as a cosmologist to take seriously this information, as a cosmologist, I can apply this to cosmology, or if you study black holes, I can take this information seriously and say, okay, there are black holes should be regular in the interior. Cosmologists should not have an initial singularities. So I can try to work on scenarios that are consistent with this. But let me go to the next step, that is, and the focus of this talk, that is to extract information regarding the vacuum state in the early universe, at the bounds, if you want, from the expression of the transition amplitudes in loop quantum gravity. So the plan of this talk is, with the remaining time that I have, that is very little, but I'm sure I can achieve it to tell you how I can define cosmological state and how I can extract quantum fluctuations from them. So that's what I wanted to do in the remaining time. And so the strategy, as I said, is to work with transition amplitudes. And we were discussing before the idea that transition amplitudes gives me the probability to go from one state of the geometry to another state. But in fact, I can also do something else. So here, well, I am picturing an initial spin network state that goes into a different spin network state. So if you want, I have transformed one quantum space-time into three quantum space-time, something like this. Very much in the same spirit of what you do when you compute transition amplitudes in quantum field theory. But there is also something else that I can do. So the boundary of my space-time, the boundary of my process, doesn't have to be split into two parts, an initial and final state. I can also take just one boundary, one three-dimensional geometry, and look at the sum over all possible four-dimensional Lorentzian geometries that are compatible with that. So if you want, you can think of this as a transition from nothing into the state. So instead of having one state and the other state, let me take one state fixed and make the other state smaller and smaller to the point in which there is just nothing, and I transition from nothing into something. So this is exactly what corresponds to the definition of a Hartle-Hawking state. And I wanted to give you a bit more a way to think about this Hartle-Hawking state in a rather different way than the one you may have seen if you have worked with it. So if I start with standard cosmology, so this is the Hamiltonian in the case of cosmology, the Hamiltonian constraint in the case of cosmology. And let me add, well, I can add some matter, or I can add the cosmological constant, just to make things more clear. So then what we do when we compute the transition amplitude is to compute basically the Hamilton-Jacobi function. And so if I compute this integral, what I have in the case of cosmology with a cosmological constant is just a difference equation between an initial and a final volume. So when I do the quantum version of this, this difference appears here in the exponential, and this corresponds to a factorization between the probability of the universe to have a certain volume with the probability of the universe to have another volume. So there is a factorization that happens here in a, when I consider partition function in the first order. And this is a factorization that appears also when I do the loop quantization. So I have exactly the same thing in the first order. Of course, there could be other terms. But if I think of my transition amplitudes as having an expansion in the number of vertices, so I have a zero order where there are no vertices. So here I'm representing my initial and final geometries in this way. I can do a first order that is when I have just one vertex, and then there is an expansion in which I can add more and more vertices. So, but you see that when I have just one vertex, there is a factorization between a transition from something into nothing and from nothing into something. So I can just consider one piece of this transition, the transition from something, from nothing into something, and I call this a spinform version of a Hartle-Hawking state. Okay. So this is the kind of object that I'm gonna use. It's as I said, it's a Hartle-Hawking state with where I have on the boundary a given three-dimensional geometry, and I am summing over all possible four-dimensional geometries. And this geometry are Lorentzian one, and this is a pivotal difference with respect to the Hartle-Hawking case, because the loop quantization is such that you don't need to include a Euclidean phase in order to compute this amplitude. So I can do a calculation that is fully Lorentzian, and gives me a state, a quantum state of the geometry. So something I can do immediately if I consider the case with a cosmological constant that I have shown you before. Careful here, because Carlo said that if I wanted to add properly the cosmological constant in the calculation, it could be cumbersome. Here, I can just add an effective term that take care of the presence of the cosmological constant. And if I do so, I can check that my transition amplitudes in the semi-classical regime, in which on the boundary I take semi-classical states in the form of coherent states. So in this case, my amplitude is indeed peaked on the classical solution of the Einstein equation, so in the case of the sitter and the sitter cosmology. So the classical limit is well defined, but what we want to do is in fact to study the fully classical regime. And one more ingredient that I have to add is to tell you about the state that is on the boundary. So I said I can use, if I am interested in the semi-classical limit, I can use a coherent states, and coherent states can be picked on an arbitrary classical geometry. So with this coherent states loop quantum gravity, I can choose a homogeneous and isotropic geometry where I can pick my states. So in this sense, they are cosmological states. But I can also do something else just using the full spin network states that, as you have seen before, they are graph states. So using a graph state is a way in which you truncate the degrees of freedom of your theory to a finite number. And the number of degrees of freedom that you wanted to include depends on the problem you're interested in. So you see a correspondence here with the cosmology, because we said at the beginning that cosmology is when, instead of working with full general relativity, we restrict ourselves to one or few degrees of freedom. So working with a graph is a natural way in which we can account for this finite number of degrees of freedom. So we set a graph on the boundary, and what we can do in order to talk about cosmological state is, first of all, to choose a graph that is regular, where, for instance, the degree at each node is the same everywhere, and then what I can do is also to pick up a certain value for the areas that are associated to the links of this graph. I can choose all the areas to be the same, but careful that even if I fix the area to be the same everywhere, I can still have fluctuations of the geometry in the fact that the volumes are not completely fixed and can fluctuate. So this is the kind of computation that I want to do. I want to see a generic state of loop quantum gravity that is defined by my Hartle-Hawking state, in the sense that it's not just an arbitrary state, but it's the state that is chosen by the dynamics of the theory. So the transition amplitude projects on the physical state of the theory and gives me a resulting state that is a superposition of spin network states in which I have I can fix the spins, but I can let the intertwiners fluctuate. I can let the volumes fluctuate. And then I can study correlations between these volumes. And this is what I want to do. So again, working with a simple graph, with a simple triangulation to do cosmology is nothing new. And this was done, for instance, in Raja calculus. And here you can see that in this old work by Collis and Williams, they were taking 5 or 16 or 600 tetrahedra to model the universe. So you may ask, why this number? Well, because 5, 16, and 600 tetrahedra are what you need in order to take a regular triangulation of a trisphere. So if you want, so it could be convenient to model the universe as a trisphere and chop my trispheres in regular cells. So, and the best way to do this is to triangulate it. So the problem is that you have to work with 5 or 16 or 600 tetrahedra, that is going to be a lot. So what we did was to start with 5. And this is what you have. So you can think of this, as I said, as a state that goes from nothing into 5 cells. So from nothing into a trisphere with divided into 5 cells. And so I have to use the full machinery of the spinform transition amplitudes to compute this. I have one vertex here. And what I can do is, well, first of all, let me mention the fact that to compute these things, of course, we cannot do this analytically. We have to do these computations numerically, and the codes to do so are available online here. Yes. So.
Francesca, are you summing over spins or only fixing them and summing over interpliers?
So I'm fixing the spins, and I study the behavior of the intertwiners.
So you fix all the spins to be some large J. That's
yes. Coming. So the J gives me a global proxy for the size of the universe, if you want.
Oh, I see. So for each J, you sum over the intertwiners and you get an amplitude.
Yes.
For that J.
Yeah. Okay. And what you can see is that it's taking five different regions of the universe. In each region, I have a different volume, and I wanted to know how this volume is correlated with the others. So I can compute volume, and I can also compute the dihedral angles that are associated with the curvature. So I can define correlations in this way. So I can compute one observable in a given region, and or say in a given tetrahedra, another observable in another tetrahedra, and compute correlations and compute the spread. And I can also compute the entanglement entropy that gives me a bound on the correlation. So the first result that we obtained, the first check you have to do is that what you are modeling is indeed the tree sphere. So by computing the dihedral angles, we could check that these are indeed giving the value that corresponds to a tree sphere. That is what we expected, but was not obvious at all. And then we can study, as I said, the spread of the angles, and we can study the correlations. And the result is that the correlations are not zero. That is already something very interesting. The problem with this model is that everything is connected with all the other tetrahedra. So each tetrahedra has one side that interacts with one of the other. So it's not completely surprising that we got correlations there. So we tried to do better. The first thing that we could do was just a refinement. So we go from one to five tetrahedra, and then we take one more step in which, so we split each tetrahedra into four, and we have 20 tetrahedra on the boundary. And we study correlations, well, the dihedral angle, the spread, and the correlations in this case. So what we wanted to do here when we studied the entanglement entropy is to say, to take, for instance, one of these tetrahedra and compute the entanglement entropy with respect to the rest of the geometry. And again, when in doing so, when we have this kind of 20-cell situation, we have seen that the resulting geometry remembers of the origin from so they remember from which of these original tetrahedra they originated. So there is what is really meaningful is to work with the 16-cell model. The 16-cell is the next regular triangulation of a tree sphere that is regular after the five cell one. And the geometry that we have studied in this case, well, is extremely interesting because you have tetrahedra that are not necessarily in touch with one another. So you can say that there are some regions of space-time, some tetrahedra, that are adjacent to one another. There are some regions in which you need to go through one intermediate tetrahedra to be connected, and there are some other tetrahedra that needs like two jumps to go from one to the other. So in this sense, so you can think of this as a notion of distance between regions. So there is a sense in this geometry in which there are regions that are adjacent and regions that are distant. So this is extremely nice because then you can study the correlation, and you can see if you have less correlation for distant chunk of volumes and more correlations for adjacent volumes. So what we have been able to see so far is how the model works in the case of the topological theory, so the BF model, so without imposing, if you want, the symplicity constraint. And we see the presence of correlations, even though we are not really able to pinpoint a specific dependence between adjacency and correlation. So my hope is that in the moment in which we could be able to handle the full 16-cell model with the full spin-fan dynamics, maybe this kind of behavior could be emerging. So what I hope I have given you is the idea that there is a sense in which, starting from the full spin-fan theory, we can define cosmological states, and within these states we have a recipe to study correlations there. And the next step is, on one hand, to do better and better with the numerical computations. So this is a challenge that we are tackling. On the other hand, the goal is also to connect with quantum field theory in curved space-time. That is what we use in standard cosmology. So how the correlations between different volumes are translated into correlation between different finite volume of space in standard cosmology. So we have people working on this. So let me conclude by highlighting my collaborators. So most of the work to extract information from the spinform amplitudes numerically has been done by Francesco Gozzini and Pietro Paolo Frisoni. There is currently Sophie, a master student, that is trying to understand the relations between our results and quantum field theory. And of course, this certain point should be connected also with general bouncing models. And the goal, as I said at the beginning, is not to start with a state in the early universe that is what is dictated by our current cosmological models. So not assuming that there is inflation and just patching there an initial state that fits with our idea of what the cosmological model should be. So we have a quantum gravity theory that is sufficiently well-defined so that we can try to do a computations offer what is the prediction from quantum gravity or what the initial state should be, which correlations should be there. And so maybe we can revise our cosmological model at the light of it. Are there correlations such that maybe inflation may last less? Or are there correlations such that maybe inflation is not even necessary? So these are the kind of questions that we want to tackle with this work. Thank you for all your attention.
So if you have to take a comfort break, go ahead. Otherwise, I'll just open the floor to questions.
Thank you.
Yes, as long as you want to be here.
Or I can tackle questions during the coffee break. But yes, Ted, please.
There's something I didn't quite understand about, you're summing over intertwiners but fixing the J's. But I would have thought a geometry on the three sphere topology, which consists of the values of the spins on the edges and the intertwiners. But it sounds like, no, you're looking at the geometry as just the spins on the edges, and the intertwiners are something else. But I don't understand what else. I thought they were part of the geometry.
Yes, they are part of the geometry, but...
So why do you sum over them and rather than fixing them? I mean, I understand you wouldn't have anything to sum over.
Yeah, I wanted to let the intertwiners free because I want to see. Otherwise, if I fix everything, I cannot.
Yeah, I understand that, but on the other hand, I don't see how it's consistent with the basic idea of spin foam quantum gravity.
Yeah.
Where I thought that the or let's say of this spin network state. So you want a wave function that gives an amplitude for each spin network.
Yeah.
But it seems like to specify the network, you have to specify both the edges and the intertwiners.
Well, of course,
summing in different sense. So in the sense you're saying, she's not summing the intertwiners. She's studying how the state depends on the intertwiners.
No. That's not what she said.
Well,
I'll ask you more later.
Yeah, no, happy to do that. But of course, fixing the spins limits the possible intertwiners that I can have. Of course, yes.
Yes, good one. I do not see anything. No question on that.
Well, I will be happy to answer more questions during the coffee break.